This is two. At the end of one, we were looking at why people are difficult. And we were looking at that broad underlying element in us all that is at the root and the heart of all our difficult behaviors. It is sin, and it is the fall. And it is that pride and arrogance that says that we can get our needs met best. The opposite is that I can trust God to meet my needs. I don't have to demand that other people meet my needs, and I don't have to desperately try to get them met myself. Instead, I can trust Him. He's very big, and He's very good. James puts it so well, you quarrel and fight, you do not have, because you do not ask God. That's in chapter 4, verse 2. Let us go on then to look at some external factors which promote difficult behavior. And then we will look at some more specific internal factors as to why people become difficult. So first of all, external factors. And here's one for you. Is the difficult person in the wrong place? Are there positional stressors that are making this person difficult? This is a major problem in the church, isn't it? People become difficult because they are given responsibilities beyond their level of spiritual or relational maturity. It's not that they're just difficult. They are in the wrong place. They're in the wrong position. They have responsibility beyond their ability. So we need to ask, is the difficult person in the wrong spot? Are we asking too much of him or her here? Is the person trying to cope in a situation that they're ill-suited for? Let me give you an example. Laura signed up to go on a missions trip. Now, there was no screening for this. You could just sign up for the trip, and then it was assumed that she would go. Now, there was some meetings ahead of time for orientation and so on, and it became evident that Laura was having some relational difficulties, especially with one of the team leaders, with whom she was openly antagonistic and refused to work anything out. This is not exactly a good way to be starting a missions trip, is it? There was just a lot of energy and time given to taking care of the problems about Laura's involvement on the team. Later, Laura became the custodian of a church where I was to be the worship leader for a conference. And I had a small earpiece in my wireless headset that I lost. And I told Laura about this. I said, Laura, don't put yourself out at all. This is a big building. The building sat well over 1,000 people. I've been everywhere. It's a wireless. I doubt that you'll be able to find it, but I just thought I would tell you anyway. Laura looked at me with sort of a glint in her eye. And she said, why don't you check with me in the morning? And I'll see what I can do. Sure enough, when I arrived early the next day, there was Laura, and she opened her palm to show me the earpiece of my headset. And I thought about that. In the one place, in the one position, Laura had difficulties. But in the other position, Laura was a godsend. I think many of us would admit that we have just put somebody in a position in the church because they volunteered for it, or they were available. We needed to fill that slot, not necessarily because they were the best person for that position, or that that would be the best use of their gifts. When we do that, however, we run the risk of having that person become very difficult because they're in the wrong spot. It doesn't fit for them. Here now is the second external factor that promotes difficult behavior. in this case, it's not a person trying to function in a spot that doesn't fit for them. It is that the whole system itself is not functioning well. We not only have difficult people, but we have difficult, dysfunctional systems. Counselors routinely deal with dysfunctional family systems, and studies are also now being done showing how systems theory affects the family of God. The idea here is that when the system itself is not functioning well, it fosters difficult behavior and renders us impotent in dealing effectively with it. In a dysfunctional family, the family norms, for example, are largely unspoken. You're just expected to know them. At least you certainly know them once you mess up. For example, maybe an old family maxim was that you weren't supposed to talk about unpleasant things. You weren't supposed to rock the boat. And it is certainly true that in a dysfunctional family, conflict is not understood and valued. A way to resolve it is not in place. No well-defined places are provided to air grievances. Disagreement is squelched. But this is not only the case in a family, this is all too typical of the church, isn't it? The church tries to avoid conflict at all costs on misguided biblical grounds. The scripture is clear that disagreement is a fact of life and not sinful in itself. But what is sinful is if the opposing parties use the disagreement as an excuse to treat each other badly in an unloving, disrespectful, or derogatory manner. The secular world, on the other hand, treats conflict as an integral part of life. Business organizations usually have well-defined lines of authority and prescribe channels in which to bring grievances up. They expect conflict. They prepare for it. They have training seminars for their executives to learn how to handle it. They have procedures in place to deal with it. They often encourage employees to raise potential areas of conflict. They know how beneficial employee input is in working out the bugs of the organization and ultimately producing a better and more profitable product, be this services or goods. But the church is so often different, isn't it? Unlike business, it so often views a member who challenges the status quo as a negative, a troublemaker, a difficult person. And then there are those denominations who move their pastors around so frequently. For some, it's as short a time as about every 2 years. And such a structure isn't helpful in working out relationships either between the parishioners and the pastor or the pastor and the parishioners, because it takes longer than 2 years to bond and form relationships where you can risk working through the difficulties. It just takes time. So my question is, how conducive is the family system in your church to healthy, mutually satisfying relationships? If the system itself doesn't function well, it encourages the proliferation of difficult behavior rather than restraining it. And we'll be looking more later at the hallmarks of healthy community and how we can foster it and how that in itself is a deterrent to difficult behavior. Let's look at a third area of external factors that promote difficult behavior. Here's a question for you. Is yours a church which has absorbed a little too much pop psychology? For example, people are not held accountable for their difficult behavior, but are continuing to be, quote, enabled to do it, or, quote, rescued from appropriate consequences. And perhaps you know those buzzwords that get bandied about so often within our contemporary American culture. It is true that some people have used, as with all good things, certain psychological principles for their own ends. They are absorbed in themselves and constantly rehearse their issues. You can't say anything to them, but they just turn around and talk about themselves, their aches and pains, their trials, all their problems, the abuse in their lives. We feel we're walking on eggs with them. They're preoccupied with their own needs and their own neediness. And they feel, because they've absorbed a lot of the counseling mystique, that they're entitled to be so self-absorbed. Now, I'm a counselor, and I am not knocking counseling, obviously. But I have seen, like all good things, counseling techniques and counseling ideas misused and abused, and I've seen it happen in the church. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. I remember one woman who had been in counseling for many years. She would often talk about the concept of the inner child that you might know of, and it's a very good counseling principle, learning about our inner child and the needs of our inner child. However, again, it can be misused. So she always would refer to her inner child as my little girl. And she would say, oh, my little girl needs this. Or my little girl needs to play. My little girl doesn't get to play enough. She had absorbed some elements of pop psychology that just kept her in a powerless, passive response to life. Of course, as you might gather, her church couldn't count on her to follow through on commitments because no one ever quite knew if that's what her little girl would need or want. And as I recall, this woman had been a missionary and had done great exploits for God in the past, but she had been really derailed by some of the misuse of psychological technique, and it wasn't serving her at all well. Here's another example of what I mean. Very likely you've heard of the idea of venting. You know, it's so good to get things off your chest. And there are certain people who enjoy the catharsis of confronting someone. Oh, I'm just needing to be honest with you about this. I'm needing to be honest with what's going on with me. Whereas what they're really doing is not being honest, but dumping on someone else. And that isn't speaking the truth in love at all. Listen to this example of venting that I heard about in one church. Bill, the pastor, was in conflict with some of his home group leaders. So Bill invited the head of the elders board to chair a meeting with all concerned to discuss the problems. Now that sounds like a good solution. But the elder has some plans of his own, and he doesn't tell Bill anything about it. He just opens the meeting and says the following. Pastor Bill, I want you just to listen and not speak tonight. Now, home group leaders, I understand that you have some grievances with Pastor Bill. I want you all to talk about them tonight. Just speak them out. Any way that you have felt you weren't heard, that you were frustrated, that you were hurt by Pastor Bill's leadership, I want you just to speak it tonight. Now is your time to talk. And that's what happened. Pastor Bill sat for the entire evening with his head bowed, not saying anything, listening to all of these people tell him all the things that were wrong with him. It only confused the situation. It didn't do anything to mend hurting relationships. It provided ammo and support for the causes of disgruntled people. Now, this might be a technique that qualified people use in group therapy where there's safety and there's guidelines, but it was totally inappropriate for this kind of meeting and without Pastor Bill's consent. Needless to say, it really decimated him. And as he looks back on it, he realizes that that was the beginning of the demise of the whole church. So there are some examples of how psychological techniques were wrongly used in the church and promoted difficult behavior rather than helping to eradicate it. Here's the fourth and last external factor in promoting difficult behavior in the church. And I will say this one also in the form of a question. Is the difficult person going through a major life stressor? All of us go through seasons of major change in our lives that can make us difficult. Periods of grief or loss. The entrance of a new baby into the house, especially the first one. A new job, going off to college, and so on. In other words, people are going through a season or a time in their lives that's highly stressful and really bringing out the worst in them. Even positive change, of course, can be stressful. Counselors often use a standard change scale to measure the effects of stress, and clients are often surprised to see how high their score is. Certainly the death of a spouse gets high marks for stress, but so does a new marriage and the birth of a child, as I said. Even a new job that has higher pay or better working conditions is still stressful, and therefore we have less resiliency and are more apt to become difficult. An example of positive but highly stressful change in the church, of course, is moving into a new sanctuary or the calling of a new pastor. Stress lowers the immunity to conflict and to illness and just makes us all around more vulnerable. Well, those were some external factors that promote difficult behavior. How about some internal factors now? Those things that are happening on the inside of us that are not factors out there, but are those inside of us. And I'll ask these in the form of questions. Here's the first one. Is there spiritual or psychosocial immaturity here? In other words, has the difficult person simply not been taught the biblical way for how to behave in the household of faith? We have to always remember that this is a post-Christian culture, and we just can't expect any longer that families automatically raise their kids in the Judeo-Christian value system. We see this all the time in the church as well. There's just a lack of training in basic relational skills. And that's likely because, as I say, we weren't taught the basics growing up. Here's another quote from Bodily Harm by Contrario and Lauder. And they say, despite all the technological advances in telecommunication, children are growing up with fewer relational skills than ever, even basic verbal conversation. Technology exacerbates this problem, with a large part of a child's day spent looking at a screen of virtual reality of one sort or another. Kids are often reared by veritable strangers or themselves and look to their equally clueless peers for guidance. So we have to realize that many of the people coming to our churches are very psychosocially immature. And, pastors, sermons are not always the best way to change behaviors, are they? Usually relational skills are best learned in the mentoring relationship or within small groups. Psychosocial immaturity can also occur with the early onset of drug abuse. I've counseled many young people who were working very hard on their recovery from alcohol or drugs, and many of them were very immature. When they should have been learning skills and disciplining their mind and being given more responsibility and thus more freedom, they were stoned. A 20-something young man who was having a lot of difficulty with relationships came to me for counseling and said, I'm clean and sober now, but I've been zoned out on drugs since age 12. I have so much catching up to do. It's almost as if I quit growing at 12 years of age. I don't know how to relate as an adult. So we have people in the church that are socially immature, and we also have people in the church that are spiritually immature. Now, I'm not talking about the ones that have just been saved, just come to know the Lord. I'm talking about those that have been in the church for decades and are still really babes in Christ. They're sort of in a state of arrested development, and they're becoming perhaps more pseudo-religious, manipulative, hypocritical, cranky, generally more difficult. And they are increasingly less able to have a deepening, authentic walk with the Lord, and are also less able at relating well to people. In the last 300 years or so, the church has strongly emphasized evangelism and has been quite successful, but we have not been as successful at discipling those we evangelize. As a result, as I say, we have Christians who've been in the church a long time, but they are not mature. The immature Christian, says one writer, is like a new climber. He needs a guide, an experienced climber who can lead the way, point out dangers, suggest the best equipment, and offer a helping hand. The new call in the church to a disciplined life came with Richard Foster's Celebration of Discipline back in 1978. It's now being recognized in the church that the disciplines of prayer, fasting, solitude, simplicity, and so on are imperative to a deeper walk with the Lord and are tailor-made to eradicate our difficult fleshly appetites. Think about it for a minute. Why has AA been so successful? Think of what the elements are in AA. There's small group accountability. There's 12 simple, direct steps to follow. There's the big book for reference. And there's a sponsor. And you don't even start to work the program until you realize your life has become unmanageable and you're willing to be discipled, to be mentored, to be held accountable. As similarly as we in the church encourage a quality devotional life together with mentoring and small groups, we will see our people grow in maturity, grow up spiritually, and thus become flexible and resilient, well able to withstand the storms in the church and outside it. All right, here is another internal factor as to why people would be difficult. Is there psychological dysfunction? Does this person have a wounded personality, and to what degree? Parental abuse or neglect occurring in early childhood can profoundly affect one's ability to function well in relationships. You're sort of developmentally delayed emotionally, just as you can be cognitively or physically. For example, all of us had to learn to crawl. You can't miss out that step, because if you do, it'll cause problems with walking and balance later on. My mother-in-law, who's a learning disability specialist, used to teach her students to crawl, literally, if they hadn't learned that as an infant. Counselors, of course, do the same thing, but at an emotional level. Now, don't misunderstand me on this one. I am in no way excusing difficult behavior by saying, well, this person had a difficult childhood. But it is helpful to know some of your difficult person's history, if that's possible. For example, I have worked closely with a man who suffered severe incest repeatedly as a child. And if you know anything about incest, you know how it really fractures a personality. It so violates the deepest inner core of who we are. It just so utterly devastates a child's sense of their own worth and their emerging personhood. I've worked closely with a man who had severe incest repeatedly as a child, and he's well aware of the devastation that that caused in his young life. But he has turned to the Lord, and he is receiving more prayer and counsel and is working on those areas of deficit in his life, even as an adult, that came as a result of that abuse. And although he's certainly difficult at times, he's wonderful. And it's really, because I know his history, easy to have compassion and grace for him, because he knows where he's been and he knows where he's going, and he's growing by leaps and bounds. So there's an example of someone with psychological wounding, but how about those with a more complex mental disorder? Let me give you an example of a woman who called me just a couple of weeks ago. She's from a large church in another state. My friend, she told me, is pastor of congregational care in this church. And a year ago, when she was visiting me at my family's mountain cabin, she had kicked my door in and said she felt very violent toward me. She said she was angry with me because she thinks she really went too far when she disclosed to me that she is getting treatment for a multiple personality disorder. "What should I do?" asked this woman of me. "I'm afraid for my own safety, and I'm also afraid for my family. I'm afraid for her, too. I know I should have said something long before this, but I was really afraid of hurting her feelings. I was afraid of defaming her. After all, as I say, she's the pastor of congregational care." "Well," I asked her, "have you talked with the senior pastor about this, or someone who's in authority?" "Well, yes, finally I did, quite recently. I went to several people, but they didn't take it too seriously. You've got to remember that this woman is one of their staff people." Yes, this does happen in the church. And I think it's very typical that this woman didn't say anything about this behavior. We really cast a blind eye to a lot of strange and inappropriate behavior, I believe, in the church. Sometimes there's psychotic or even paranoid behavior, and we tend to suspend judgment. We are used to certain language, aren't we? We're listening to the voice of God. We want to hear God. We say, "God spoke to me." Whereas in the world, such language would be very much misconstrued as being weird and suspect. My point here is that there can be some major mental disorder, and we need to have those around us whose opinions we trust to try out our perceptions on them, to check out our misgivings, to consider whether we are dealing with a normal, difficult person or whether we're dealing with someone with a mental disorder that makes it impossible to reason with them. And it's not because they're ornery, but because they are literally unable to think clearly.